Hello, I'm Rob Nelson. Welcome to another season of the Sir Crazy Podcast.
Season four. This is an interesting place and an interesting time to be doing some podcasts, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
And I'm Mike Bakoven, the co-host and producer of the show. So today we are talking about vaccines.
Yes, it's only fitting given the current climate that we're all experiencing. And, you know, we went through the first phase, which was the pandemic phase, and we talked about that. And I think now we're going to shift gears and talk about the second half of this dilemma.
And man, am I glad the second half is here, right? So is everybody. But we're going to start off with talking with you and Carrie Stouffer from the curatorial department at Steuer Museum, who has done a really good bit of research on vaccines of the past. I learned quite a bit. There were some really fascinating bits in that conversation.
Yeah, just kind of backtracking a bit, right when the pandemic got going, Carrie and I spent a great deal of time putting together some articles for our Steuer Museum website just for posterity and to kind of keep the public at ease and to let them know that, you know, in history, pandemics have hit before and what to kind of expect to have happen. And now we're going to talk about vaccines and, you know, all those past pandemics had vaccinations that came out as well, and different rollouts have taken place. So this one's going to be right up there alongside of those.
And we also jump in and talk to Rebecca Steinke, who is a medical doctor practicing here in Grand Island, which is going to be interesting to hear a medical professional's take on what's been happening and what's going to happen here in Hall County.
Yeah, absolutely. Like as you said, she works here in Grand Island. She is a general practitioner. I don't know if that's the nomenclature that I should be using, but she has a great deal of experience, many, many years as a practicing physician, and I'll be completely interested to hear about what her expectations are for the immediate future and also any advice that she would offer to our listeners.
All right, let's get started with season four. Welcome to the Steuer Crazy Podcast. We are here today with Rob Nelson and Carrie Stouffer. Say hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hello, welcome.
And we are talking vaccines. My name is Mike Bakoven, and I am kind of helping to lead the discussion today because we have a couple people who are a lot smarter than I am and have done a lot more research about these things. So obviously the reason we're talking about vaccines is the COVID-19 vaccine is in distribution right now this second as it's happening. And what we're going to do is dive as close as we can into the history of vaccines, definitely the history in terms of the history that we cover here at Steuer Museum, which is around the 1860s to about the start of World War I. Is that about right?
I also think there's something comforting about history, no matter what topic you're really delving into. There's always, you find out how ununique you really are in the grand scheme of things. People from previous generations have gone through similar things countless times over, and if nothing else, you can learn a little bit and humble yourself from those past experiences.
I love that idea. Thank you for that. So I say where we start is at the beginning. So vaccines were something that have existed for a longer time than I think people might understand. I ran across just a story on another podcast that I listened to at one point about rubbing live pustules from cattle into open wounds as kind of being like the very, very first vaccination, and it being met with a considerable amount of controversy, as it might if it were tried today. Can you guys go back and tell me just a little bit about where vaccines started and what the first, you know, what the first ones looked like?
You know, there's not any one particular place, I would say, where a vaccine started, because there have been variations of inoculation that date back, you know, as at least until 1000 CE in China, where smallpox, which was ravaging that nation at the time, was used through a process of variolation, where ground up scabs of the smallpox disease, or of like the remnants of it, were actually ground up and blown through the nostrils of people as a form of inoculation against the disease.
Wow. And did that work?
You know, it worked fairly effectively. It was not necessarily a vaccine in the common tongue, but a statistic I read was that process of variolation would, you know, reduce the amount of, like the percentage of some of people who would die from it, from something around, you know, 15 out of 50 to 1 in 50.
Wow.
So a highly significant reduction in death.
That's a lot of lives saved, definitely. So let's get to what we might consider the modern medical age. I know we did a podcast earlier about doctor's offices and a lot of it having to do with like herbs and medicines and that sort of thing, all the way up to maybe around the 1890s. Was vaccine in the mix at that point, or was it, it was obviously something that people were aware of, but was it anything that was widely distributed?
Oh, I think vaccines since that time in China have always been important. And I think that's what, you know, Rob touched on is comforting to know, is that vaccines have been attempted for a long time. They did gain traction in more modern era. But all of that work leading up to it has really saved people a lot of heartache, and that there's a lot of diseases that don't happen now because of the previous years and years and years of work. Rob, I think you've done some research on exactly when things kind of started to modernize.
So, yeah, I mean, when you're talking about the scientific revolution, when you're talking about industrialization in general, vaccination does kind of contribute to that process. The first, what I would say vaccination in the modern parlance, I would say happened in the 1790s. A man named Edward Jenner, who's considered the founder of vaccinology as a profession, immunized a person of smallpox in 1796. It was a 13-year-old boy that he vaccinated with a strain of cowpox. And I am not a medical expert of any kind, but I know that cowpox and smallpox were related. But by introducing cowpox into the bloodstream, it made people more immune to smallpox if they contracted it later. And so that was really the first breakthrough in the modern sense of scientific immunology. Later advancements in the 19th century, 1870s, 1880s, with anthrax, with rabies, with cholera, those things would come into, you know, greater popularity in the late 19th century. Louis Pasteur becomes a huge name during this time as well. He is the person who develops the rabies vaccine in 1885. It's the last thing he actually does professionally. And around that time, you really see a movement towards the acceptance of germ theory in general and a greater acceptance to vaccines as a whole, although not entirely, as we will also talk about, I'm sure.
Right.
Well, and they really came to understand that not every disease was bacteria related.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that was a huge way that things progressed when they understood that, you know, antibiotics and antibodies weren't the key. We really needed to boost the immune system to attack something that's different, which is the virus. And that's what those early scientists really were able to differentiate.
The difference between a virus and a bacteria.
Right.
That's interesting. Can I back up a little bit? And I know we've covered some of this ground on possibly on previous podcasts and definitely on the Hall County Quarantine series, but can we talk about some of the pandemics that fall in Steuer Museum's time frame and just kind of how bad they were? I mean, are we in a where you said, Rob, that we take comfort from history?
Yeah,
people have gone through things like COVID-19 before and worse, from what I can gather.
Yeah, absolutely. So the most famous one, obviously, is the 1918 H1N1 flu, also commonly known as the Spanish flu, happened almost 100 or a little over 100 years ago now, came about in largely the same sort of way, I guess, just people coming home from the war in Europe. And this is really the first time that like a world population is kind of coming in contact with one another in a large scale way. We have that now just from our everyday life of people circumnavigating the world in various ways. It really allowed for this virus to spread faster than anything had ever spread previous to this time. When it was all said and done, and I guess that's not even the right way to say it, because it never really went away, this virus. But roughly 675,000 people in the U.S. died. 50 million people died around the world in that amount of time. And there were 500 million cases. So five times as more significant.
And there was less population at that point, too. So, I mean, it was extremely significant by the sound of it.
Yeah, because we're at 21 million worldwide right now.
Wow.
And so this was something very, very significant, and something that also targeted there were holes in what it targeted, but it targeted young children. It targeted very vulnerable, both sides, I guess, of the age groups. And so there was a lot more at risk and a lot more. Plus, you know, hygiene wasn't the way it is now. A lot of different things that made it a lot worse. And I think most people, especially around here in our area, Hall County, have stories from their grandparents, great-grandparents, about it affecting individuals that they know.
Yeah, this is three generations ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, and I'll cut this out if I'm completely off base on this. But I remember, and maybe you told me this, Carrie, that there was a log from one of the Grand Island power plants about the number of employees they had. Do you remember this? And that the numbers just kept ticking down and down and down about the time of the flu until there was just like two people providing power for the entire city, running the entire power plant. Mm-hmm. It was something
you can see a lot of, yeah, of the effects in different logs, different companies, groups. In there's many logs from the different funeral homes, and they list, you know, how people died, when they died, what age group they died. And it sadly, yeah, you can see the wave, and it's just entry after entry after entry, and family after family. You can see it when you walk through the cemeteries. Next time you're out, you know, walking around a cemetery, you can see whole family groups. And if you look at the ages and the date ranges, you can see that it was all within, you know, that 1918 time period.
That's, yeah, terrible. And keep, I'm not to downplay the COVID-19 health epidemic. I mean, this is a time, 1918, they don't have penicillin yet. Penicillin's not invented for 10 more years. There are, you know, no pharmacies that are selling anything close to the, you know, amount of protection that you can even buy yourself today. These are people that are largely just vastly underprotected from this virus that swept the nation and the world during this time. And without those breakthroughs that came about, we would undoubtedly be at much, much higher deaths and,
right,
sicknesses
because
today
the,
of COVID-19.
The treatment was fresh air.
Oh, yeah.
The treatment was prayer. The treatment was bloodletting. You know, different things. And really, when the vaccines came about, we needed these people. These are individual, really, heroes that stepped out and said, yes, you know, let me, here's my arm. I believe in this. Let's see what happens. And from there, you know, not to be a spoiler alert,
yeah,
but now we don't have smallpox, and we don't, yeah, have polio, and we don't have some of those things. Whereas just in 1918, you know, to think about what we were, as a nation, as a world, going through.
It's working better than taking a pint of blood out of my arm. So,
right?
Yeah,
or scratching the surface and rubbing some, you know, somebody else's scab,
wow,
in it. Just, but, you know, to be blunt.
Yeah.
But that's not, I mean, that's the one that gets the most attention, the 1918 flu epidemic. But I mean, you know, a little bit earlier than that, the tuberculosis killed 1 in 7 people every year. 60,000 people a year in America died during the 1900s from tuberculosis. In the, you know, from the 20s to the 50s, polio was a huge concern. And you see similar social distancing things like closing down movie theaters and swimming pools and those sorts of things happening then, just as they were happening now, because people weren't sure how this, you know, disease was spreading. And, you know, while only 3,000 people in one notable year's scare in 1952 died from polio, there were still 87,000 cases and 21,000 people were paralyzed just in the U.S. in 1 year from this sickness. And so, I mean, these things have just unfortunately continued to come about generationally. But I think we're still as prepared as ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that bodes
well
you for the future.
You know, we were talking about other ways that it was recorded. There are, we received, if you've listened to other Stuart podcasts and events, we received a lot of material from the Bartonbachs, from the Bartonbach Opera House and the Bartonbach building. And we have letters from the throughout the different times that the Bartonbach Opera House had entertainers come, where they said, okay, well, we'll come, but does your staff wear masks?
Yeah.
I mean, that's actually written in there. We actually, you know, well, okay, but we might close down because Colorado's already closed down, and so we can't get through Colorado to get to Nebraska. You know, and they talk about these things and traveling and being safe and it is comforting to know that this isn't the first time that, nor is it far off distant from what we had to deal with.
Your great grandparents went through this.
Yes.
And there's still, I mean, there was a couple people who were still alive. I mean, I've seen newspaper articles in the recent months of people who were, I mean, they were infants, but they were alive when this happened. So this is not ancient history by any means. We're talking still a single lifetime of a few of these people.
You know, we're talking 50s with polio and I mean, that's, you know, we don't want to date anybody, but you know, that's very recent history.
Yeah, that's very recent history. Absolutely. So here come vaccines. What were the first vaccines that were distributed in a major way that had like a major impact on people's mortality? And then I guess the question in my mind would be, were people happy about it? I mean, you know, obviously if you told me that here's something that can save your child, you know, I'd run through a wall to get it. Was that kind of the sentiment because life was so bad and if you could give me an inoculation against something that was going to kill me and my family, were people wary of it or were they excited or was there dancing in the streets? Were they grabbing nurses and kissing them? What was happening?
I think all of it.
All of it.
it's a complicated subject. I don't think there's a cut and dry black and white answer to that. Right around that same time that we were talking about earlier, late 19th, early 20th century, when, you know, there are beginning to be breakthroughs in modern medicine, you do see the rollouts of some of these vaccines that begin to take place. And I think that those are largely met with a good deal of acclaim. I don't think that they are universally met with acclaim. And we still see that today, unfortunately.
No, I think as long as there has been vaccinations, there have been people that were concerned and leery about,
right.
I mean, I can't imagine that, you know, back in the day in China, you weren't going, you're going to do what?
Yeah.
Blow what up my nose?
Exactly.
So, I mean, it's just, it's human nature and it's part of the process that we have to all work through. I think what Rob and I have talked about is that, you know, the polio vaccination and the history of that really kind of mirrors.
Yeah, it's striking.
In a way. And so...
And I can go into a little bit of that. The polio vaccine, beginning in 1955, met with universal acclaim right off the bat. Jonas Salk.
Because polio was bad.
Polio was terrible. And, Jonas Salk, everyone knows, polio vaccine. He's the guy that did it. It was amazing, right? Everything was perfect and it solved everything. Well, yes. But also it took a little bit of time to get there after the vaccine was invented. I just have to say, because I'm a presidential history nerd, that Dwight Eisenhower thanks Jonas Salk personally. He says, I have no words. Thank you. I am very, very happy. This is a president who has grandchildren himself, and it's killing young children, paralyzing children for their lives. You know, this is a huge deal. Unfortunately, you know, much like today, where there's some dispute as to, does the federal government distribute this vaccine? Do the state governments distribute this vaccine? Mm-hmm. A similar sort of ordeal takes place in 1955, where the federal government doesn't foresee it as it's their responsibility to really distribute this and have this large federal program to inoculate the entire country. They thought that it was more the organization known as the March of Dimes that had been responsible for generating the revenue and the research for the vaccine trials itself. It was their responsibility for the rollout. So you see this slow rollout of it. And that's unfortunately coupled with this incident that took place as well, called the Cutter incident, where, you know, unfortunately, one of these laboratories that was distributing the vaccine shipped a contaminated batch to a location in Idaho where 11 children were unfortunately killed by a...
They were given
polio.
They were given polio by a live virus.
Right.
So, yeah...
I had no idea the March of Dimes actually was responsible for the vaccine distribution. That's really interesting.
If you go back to that organization actually began as a birthday party thrown kind of on a routine basis for Theodore Roosevelt. And they started to raise money for polio victims and for paralyzed victims. And that raised, went from a birthday party to more of a fundraiser to a different organization to what eventually is the March of Dimes. So yeah, we're not looking at a state organization. We're not looking at really anything that's very, well, they're an organized organization.
Yeah.
But that's who the country thought should be distributing these great amounts of vaccine. I mean, millions of people across the world. But, you know, it gets straightened out. It gets straightened out.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where I imagine just the number. I mean, you hear numbers of the number of people who were vaccinated and how quickly they were vaccinated against polio. And if I'm not mistaken, there were some efforts in like schools and stuff like that. You hear people saying, I got the polio vaccine in school or whatever it was, right? And so with something that wide, there's bound to be some margin of error, right? I mean, someone's bound to put the wrong sticker on the wrong package at some point. But I think if history can point toward anything, it's just the amount of good that was done by that, just far, 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 just by exponential leaps and bounds outweighs the damage of something like the Qatar incident.
Absolutely. I mean, you're talking about millions of lives that have been, you know, either saved or who have avoided permanent paralysis or long time injuries that would have affected them negatively. Millions of people.
Well, and millions of generations that come after us. Because right now, our children are not facing polio, and their children are not facing polio. And if we keep up with, you know, all of the scientific ways that things can be improved, they will never have to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. And I would just say, you know, like, again, everyone has this very great image of Jonas Salk, and he's the guy who did it. In 1960, however, the Jonas Salk vaccine is actually replaced by another vaccine, much like today, where there's different vaccines that have just come out in the recent weeks. Multiple different vaccines have come out that are, you know, different levels of effectiveness taken in different ways. And another person who was working at the, who was the director of the Cincinnati Children's Hospital at this time, his name was Albert Sabin, developed a vaccine that most people listening to this might remember, which is the one that is the vaccine that's taken orally. The children take on a sugar cube, and it's a one-time vaccine.
Right, right.
And that, starting in 1960, began to be really phased in the United States as the popular method of taking this vaccine, whereas Jonas Salk's vaccine was actually an injection.
Right. And if anyone remembers, I don't know if you were here during this time, Rob, but I'm sure Kerry remembers long time Grand Island mayor and advocate Ken Gannott. I just remember his the truck he drove for 15 years had the same bumper sticker on the back, and it said something along the lines of "Goodbye polio, thank you Rotary." You know, it was a Rotary Club thing. You know, so I mean, this is not ancient history at all.
No, yeah. It's not, and it's good to look back and to see those similarities and to see those efforts and the grassroots efforts that happens right in our communities, all the way up through then, you know, the federal government, but beyond into worldwide, because, you know, that second vaccine really is what the world grabbed onto. Mm-hmm. Even though Salk is what's remembered, it's that second vaccine that really eradicated or got us to the point we needed to be at. It
was nearly eradicated, yeah. So I want to dive a little bit deeper into methods of vaccine delivery. You talked about the sugar cube, you know, we talked about the March of Dimes, how they were the ones who were responsible for the rollout, which I learned today and just blew my head off. That's incredible. At what point did this become just sort of a common thing? You know, I mean, did it ever really normalize to the point where, you know, when I got my kids vaccinated, it was second nature. It was just something that was part of preventative care. How did we get from that point, you know, how did we get all the way from the March of Dimes running it to, you know, where we were, you know, before the pandemic, where a lot of these vaccinations were just considered all but normal?
I would actually say that as long as there have been vaccinations, there have been laws that have sought to regulate people getting vaccinations. If you go back to England in the 1850s, for instance, there was the Vaccination Act of that year, which made it mandatory for infants up to 3 months old And then in 1867, there was an act that extended the age requirement to 14 years old. Everyone under that age had to get vaccinated with the smallpox vaccine. And, you know, there were like instances of that happened throughout the 1870s and 1880s. And as a result, you do see the rise of these anti-vaccination leagues and societies and organizations in both the U.S. and in Europe. And then, I mean, you can just really see it, the parallels between then and now.
Yeah, once there's a law enacted, then there is a group formed, you know, and for all different reasons, you know, for civil liberties, for safety, for all the different reasons. But I think that what history shows is that, you know, the good arguments, good and proper arguments, is what leads to the best solutions. You know, I think, Rob, I don't know if you have the details on the years, but more and more laws were enacted to require different things, and it just became more normalized. However, there's always going to be, you know, people checking in and checking up. But I think that the laws and the requirements, the government's desire, the health organization's desire to get people to where there's a point of herd immunity, mm-hmm. and where there's a point where, you know, nature can take back
right
what nature is supposed to be doing.
I kind of wanted to touch on this, and this isn't on the list of things we were talking about, so if we need to back off, we can. But collective action. Okay, so vaccines work because they eventually get to that point you were talking about, Carrie, where nature starts to take back. I really like that phrase. It seems to me like the best way to battle something like, you know, the flu, like polio, is collective action, right? And if there's one thing that I think has been lacking in the current pandemic, and I don't want to politicize this too much, but we're talking about a lack of, I think objectively, we can look at this and say, no matter what, you know, what part of the political spectrum you're on, that there has not been collective action. And that seems to be part of the thing that is not working for this particular pandemic. Does any of that kind of ring throughout history to you at all?
I think on a...
Because you were talking about like leagues
in Grand
being
Island,
developed.
Yep, yeah, in yeah. Grand Island itself, all the way, you know, growing and growing into the state, into the area and whatnot. Mm-hmm. There have been people that, you know, don't want to be part of that collective effort for various reasons, like we talked about. There were definitely people in Grand Island that wanted things open and didn't want their businesses closed. It's the same thing. Everybody has to make a living. Everybody has to be able to continue to do things. And so how do you do that?
Right.
Because, you know, everybody going in one direction isn't always the quickest way. Everybody's going to bump into each other, and there's going to be those conflicts. So how do we get most everybody on the road going in one direction? I think is a normal thing.
Yeah, and I would just highlight that these are things that do get worked out in courts of law and, you know, in political bodies all over the place. Following a smallpox outbreak in 1902, which was in Massachusetts, Cambridge, Massachusetts mandated that all the residents of that city get vaccinated against smallpox, for instance, and there was a person whose name was Henning Jacobson who refused to vaccinate on the grounds that it violated his right, in his opinion, to care for his own body the way he knew best. And that case made it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Wow.
And in 1905, the Supreme Court for the first time ruled that the courts, the legislative bodies of this U.S. have the power to enforce state laws of public health. So whether or not, since 1905, There at least has been grounds for state and local governments to pass laws, if they so choose, to enforce these sorts of measures.
Right. I think that's the kicker right there.
And maybe, you know, places don't want to do that. Maybe they don't do that. Maybe some do. But at least, you know, there is that backing at the federal level that says you can do it. You know, we'd all like everybody to be more participatory in such measures like that.
No, but I really think the 1905 law is important to talk about, because that's really when, you know, we said there has to be a rule.
Right.
We all agree, and we're all going to sit here and say we have to have a rule to follow, and we have to be guided. We can't just make individual decisions anymore because, you know, nature doesn't automatically look at us as individuals. Yeah. It's going to slam all of us at once, and if we're going to take care of it, we got to be on, you know, in the same boat. So that's what that law is. And there, you know, again, I fully believe that you have to always have, you know, checks and balances, and you have to have somebody checking in and making sure that, you know, those rules are appropriate, those rules are what's best, and that those rules still work for the goals that they were intended for. But I think that's, again, going back to that normalcy of how we get to a point where, yeah, this is what's best. You know, I can remember, and I don't know if this is appropriate to share, but I can remember when the seatbelt law was enacted.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It drove me nuts.
Personal liberty versus
public
safety.
Like, I do not want to have to put this seatbelt on every single day, and I don't need it. And, you know, I can think of the million stupid things that went through my head. Mm-hmm. And now it's a regular thing, and I can't drive my car without having my seatbelt around me. Yeah. You know, and our children don't even know. You know, I talk about this or that, and I'm like, oh yeah, we were in the back of the car, you know,
bouncing
holding
around
on the bumper, and they're like, what? So, I mean, that's how those things get normalized and and move on from there.
All right, so I want to bring this in for a landing a little bit on a high note. Can you talk to me about how effectively some of these things were dealt with? So we touched on this a little bit, especially with polio, because polio, you said, spoilers, Rob, was basically very close to eradicated from the earth. So with the flu, with polio, with, you know, everything else, all the pandemics we've talked about, did vaccines work? Did we have a happy ending to these things as far as it went?
Vaccines absolutely work. They absolutely work. If anyone tells you otherwise, they're wrong. Plain as day, end of story, black and white. Smallpox vaccine, it was effective. It is now not a problem. I think it's been eradicated from the world for the most part. Polio, also nearly eradicated from the globe, as far as I'm aware. Now,
late 70s, I think.
Yeah, you know, and again, I'm not a medical doctor, and I don't know these.
We will be speaking with a medical doctor in the second half of this podcast. Yeah,
completely. Yeah. But these are not, you know, issues in the way that they were 100, 200 years ago because of the advent of vaccinations against them to fight them. Now, something with the 1918 pandemic, which they never found a vaccination for, and that disease changed.
It's still a variant today.
Yeah, it's still a variant.
That's what we all are still working to get vaccines for today.
Exactly. And it you know, a variant changed into another variant, changed into another variant, which in that instance, luckily, made it less devastating to the human body. And it's, you know, it reduced substantially the amount of people that died slowly during the early 1920s. But that's a fluke occurrence that just happened to go our way.
So last time I had the flu, it's quite possible that there is a shred of the thing that killed, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people throughout the country.
Yeah, yes. It's an ancestral type of thing, just like any other kind of ancestral type of thing. So.
I feel kind
of
honored. Remember that?
Well, you can specifically see, like with measles, you can see with the number of vaccinations given and taken, the measles goes down. It gets very close to a tipping point where it's eradicated. And then there's something in the world that changes the ability for people to get that, whether it's people's decisions to have the vaccination or, you know, a worldwide event. And you see those measles go back up. You see the rise of those numbers again. So it definitely, vaccinations work and they affect the population.
And ironically, what seems to happen is as a result of the positive outcome of the vaccine, no matter what the disease is, it leads to people not taking it seriously to the point that they doubt the need for a vaccine.
Right, right. Self-perpetuating loop.
And it's just mind-boggling that that continues to happen over and over again, generation after generation. But you see it almost after every vaccination that's developed. It has such a monumental, impact on the spread of that disease. And then people come about and say, well, hey, you know, I don't need it.
I've never heard anyone with polio.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, last thing as we wrap up. So what, from a historian's standpoint, what should we be thinking about with this current vaccine rollout, with the vaccine for COVID-19, which, you know, let's talk about it a little bit, rolled out in record time, super fast. Listening to a couple things about it, it seems like they had the formula for what they were going to do just weeks after the entire pandemic began, and they were able to put a lot of the information online. People worked together, just a massive worldwide effort. What should history teach us about what's happening right now this second?
Well, I think that just, you know, what I said at the beginning of the podcast, which is there are those examples in history that you can look to as guidepoints, and smart people in leadership positions should absolutely do that no matter what level of leadership you're at. I promise you, someone in your position has had a similar experience before and they went through it. Go read what they went through. Mm-hmm. It's out there. The examples are out there to follow. And, you know, the polio example especially is so reminiscent of what we're going through today. And in the long run, that one worked out. It took a little bit longer than everybody was hoping. And, you know, in that interim period of a year, 2 years, 3 years, you know, people were resistant. You know, unfortunately, there was a bad encounter that soured a lot of people on that immediate good news, which, you know, led to a little bit more of a delay. But in the long run, it all worked out because of that implementation and trust in vaccinations and trust in medical professionals insisting and insisting and insisting that you have to do this, you have to do this, you have to do this. Mm-hmm. And that positive outcome was we no longer deal with polio.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, the whole idea of the continuum of history is important to remember that, yep, you know, check out what's happened before, what people have done before, add your wisdom and your knowledge to it. And what our gift to our kids is that they do not have to deal with this specific coronavirus. And they'll know better how to handle any variant of the coronavirus.
Yeah.
And thank goodness we had those people that delved into the science and, you know, a lot of bravery and, you know, took some really nasty forebears to vaccination for us and got us to the point we are in the world.
Well said. All right. Well, Lord and the vaccine willing, we will be looking back in a couple months saying we all survived the pandemic of 2020, which is not a small thing to be able to say. I'm looking forward to be able to say that. And thank you both so much for all your research and time you spent researching this topic. It's been a lot of good pieces in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I know it's kind of a downer. I don't know that everybody likes to listen to talks about vaccines or pandemics right now, but in the long run, I think everyone will be better for having listen to it and listen to experts.
Yeah, and definitely listen to the medical professionals in your area or coming up on the podcast and, you know, search out those wise voices.
All right. And we will be back with the aforementioned medical professional right after this.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Platte Valley Tin Shop. For custom-made tinware and general repair, see Mr. L. Miller for the Platte Valley Tin Shop on North Front Street, Railroad Town, Nebraska.
And welcome back to the Stir Crazy podcast. We are here with Dr. Rebecca Stanky, who is a family medicine doctor in the Grand Island community. Dr. Stanky, thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So to continue our conversation just about vaccines, clearly there is a huge problem happening right now in our own time. We talked about history in the first part of the show, but now we're going to speed things up to the contemporary moment in time. Just kind of reflecting on where we've been over this last crazy 10 plus months, how do you think the medical community of this area reacted in the early days of this pandemic, and was the community quick to respond?
Well, I think that the medical community was like a lot of the general public. We could see news from overseas. We heard, oh gosh, New York and Washington are getting hit with this new virus, but maybe we're protected here because we're like small town Nebraska, you know. But then quickly, things changed. And I feel like our medical community jumped into high gear pretty fast. We got news, of course, from the CDC, from colleagues in different parts of the country. And my clinic in particular, we opened up a separate area for patients. We quickly decided everyone should wear a mask, tried to get protocols, but those things would change day to day or week to week because of the changing science around this.
We're talking about wearing masks and those kind of procedures. Before the pandemic hit, would you say parents were more open to the idea of vaccination than now, or have the protocols kind of changed as to how you approach that conversation with parents or different groups?
With parents, I guess I look at it as before this pandemic, vaccines were kind of considered to be, yes, just for kids. There were a few for adults, you know, you get your pneumonia shot or your flu shot, things like that. But they were, I think the discussion around vaccines was mainly relegated to the doctor and the mom and dad or caregiver and say, here's what your kids should have. I really don't think the acceptance of vaccines for kids has changed that much, but the discussion is a lot more public now.
Yeah.
Public health jumping in and wanting to stop this pandemic with the vaccine giving us some immunity to it.
What do you say to those people out there who, you know, they listen to the news reports and they hear over the course of 10 months that obviously things are going to change when you're responding to something that's completely brand new? What do you say to those people who kind of find their own sources and make up their minds for themselves, regardless of what medical experts might say?
Well, I think part of that is obviously the frustration that this is new. And there's what I see as a misunderstanding of how science works in a way. Not to say that people aren't smart enough to get that, but when we are used to hearing from experts, this is the way it is, and it doesn't change, and then suddenly an expert says something, and a week later they say something different, people get very frustrated and they turn to different sources, alternative sources. But I've used an analogy with in speaking and with patients that it's like if we travel somewhere new, if you go to a new city, and you've never been there, you don't speak the language, all you know is north, south, east, west, and that's it. You start driving down a street and realize you're going the wrong way, you're not gonna turn around and go back down that street over and over. You're gonna turn around and go a different way. And that is how science works. And that's the analogy I put forth, because obviously at first the thought was, masks may not make a difference, we need to save them for everybody else that in healthcare. But then quickly realized masks are gonna stop this faster if everybody wears them everywhere they go. So it's not like people were lying at the beginning.
Sure.
It's just within weeks, scientists saw how this virus spread and could make firm guidelines about it.
So, you know, here we are 10 months down the road. Do you foresee this getting better in the immediate future in terms of the rollout? Has Grand Island begun that process of rolling out this vaccine? And have you heard about how that's going so far?
So regarding vaccine rollout and our local public health department, I'm in a good position because I get to work with them closely as their medical consultant. I don't tell them what to do at all, but I can help with answering some specific questions. But I really rely on our public health experts here. And I think Grand Island has done a great job. Our local health department has done a great job of being prepared. Part of the rollout problems have been, initially we thought we'd get, say, 1,000 doses and then get half of those. So there's been a lot of little bumps in the road, some delays, things like that. But as the vaccine comes to our area, there are nurses and lots of people ready to go, geared up. They have the supplies, they have the staff. So I feel like we are in a great spot. There are phases and tiers of who gets the vaccine first. We've already worked through the first phase with medical people. Next week, Grand Island perhaps maybe not till the end of January, but planning to roll into phase 1B, which means elderly, and then working through more and more people to get the vaccine.
Yeah, I've heard that there's phase 1A, 1B, 1C, and then it, does it translate after that to phase 2, which would be the general population who doesn't fall into one of those categories?
Right. For instance, the initial plan was 75 and older in the general population. I could back up a little bit. The elderly, or even people who aren't necessarily old but are medically frail in a facility, they were in the top priority. So facilities, long-term care, nursing homes, they contracted separately with a lot of the pharmacies, and they got their own vaccine supply and got them out quickly. So that was done late December, early January. That included staff at those facilities too. But then as it moves down into general public, the goal is initially everyone 75 and over. And just brand new, as of yesterday, the state said, let's start at 65 years of age and older. So it really greatly expands the population that are eligible to get that shot right now. So it means gearing up and getting ready as fast as possible once the vaccine is here.
Absolutely.
So I'm just ask a question.
Yeah, go ahead. Carrie Stouffer, everybody.
So do you foresee when we do that? So, you know, they did the private contracting, and that was great. I heard a lot of the places around here, you know, are done. They've gotten their vaccine. When we do tier two, do you foresee that we're going to be doing the mass vaccinations, you know, like they did in the past with polio, where everybody goes somewhere and stands in a line? Or are we small enough that everybody will have to go, you know, to their general clinic or wherever to get the vaccine?
Yeah. I think it'll probably be a little bit of both.
Okay.
I just know that as a, you know, in our clinic, we've applied with the government, with the state, to be a dispenser or a distributor of the vaccine. There are a couple other clinics in our 3-county area that are doing the same. But I tell my patients, we're not certain how long that will take. It might be a couple weeks, it might be 6 weeks before we get actual vaccine in our clinic. So if a person can get the shot at the health department or at a pharmacy first, I tell them, go do it. I also know that the health department is working out a mass vaccine plan. And just because of the conditions of COVID, no, we're not going to stand shoulder to shoulder in
right.
line.
Sure.
It'll be a drive-up, probably a drive-up vaccine clinic, similar to how they have the drive-up testing. So they're trying to work out details for have people ready and loaded with the shots. And as people drive up, they say, here's my name, and get their shot, get the card, and here's when you come back for your second dose. So those are in the works, yes.
Hopefully that comes sooner rather than later for everybody. I think everyone's just waiting for that day. I'd like to shift gears just for a kind of go just a little bit different direction. But I've read myself just a few articles that there is some level of hesitancy, not just from the general public, but also from healthcare workers as well to getting this vaccine. And that I'm not really clear as to why that is. And I was just hoping you could maybe elaborate on that for me, for my own selfish reasons.
Yeah. Well, I don't think they're selfish reasons. It's like, why do people not want to get this done and be
yeah.
through this?
Especially people who are overworked, and as healthcare workers are over this last year. I mean, you see stories every day about how, you know, understaffed, just exasperated, exhausted mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. our healthcare infrastructure is. And to see that, you know, maybe 30%, 40% of, you know, nurses are doubting whether or not they're going to get the vaccine when they can is kind of baffling.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have my own opinions about
sure.
that. I think some of the hesitancy is among workers who maybe weren't right in the thick of it, but perhaps nurses who were in a different part of the hospital or worked in surgery facilities or places where they didn't actually take care of patients as closely, or even some that have been taking care of them and didn't get COVID and thought, well, maybe I don't really need this. So I think there's, unfortunately, yes, I think there is a little bit of that, hey, I'm tough, I'm okay, I don't need this. But then there's also hesitancy because of some of the terminology, I think, around the way this was explained to the public, that this was a fast-tracked vaccine.
Sure.
And I really feel that was, I mean, it was meant to be, hey, look how exciting this is. We got this done fast. However, the small print was, this has been studied for decades. The science behind these vaccines has been, the mRNA vaccine, the way these are being, the way these vaccines work to create antibodies in a safe manner has been studied for a long, long time. And now there's a real life pandemic to apply that science. And so I tell people, no, this isn't a brand new thing that just came up 6 months ago. I mean, there have been scientists working on these types of vaccines since even, you know, 10 years ago, SARS, MERS, you know, all those kinds of different viral little pandemics. So now there's very brilliant people who have the ability to figure this out, and they can apply it and help us.
I was under the assumption that over the course of this last year, there were so many people who, you know, kind of not abandoned what they were previously doing research-wise in whatever academic discipline they were a part of. But I feel like this just became the issue of our time, that so many people probably came together and, you know, started researching this and borrowing from other people and really coming together as a collective to really address this problem in a way that has never happened before this moment. I don't know if there's a lot of validity to that. It's just something that I've assumed has been happening, which is also, as you said, it's been going on for years and years, that kind of collaboration. But has that been expedited, I guess, during this last year even more so?
Yes, I think it has too. I mean, we know that a lot more money was appropriated toward get this done. And so I can't state for fact, you know, certain studies were put on the back burner to do this, but we know that there are labs that different companies, they obviously geared up to really work harder at it.
Yeah. So I guess what would be your advice, if you're comfortable sharing with it, to anyone in the general public who's uneasy about getting the vaccination? What would you advise them as a medical doctor?
I always say my short answer is it's safe. I've already had mine.
Oh, good.
Got my second dose last week, and I can honestly say that I've been more sore after a hard workout. So I can't. And so I know I have seen people and talked with friends and colleagues who, yeah, they've got, you know, sore arm, maybe a fever a couple days later. But I honestly have not talked to anyone who couldn't work the next day or within a few days of the vaccine. So I guess personal experience, I think, hopefully, if people hear that from their doctor or other people in the community that they trust, they'll take that to heart. I just want to touch on one of the myths that have been out there about the vaccine that I think has prevented some younger women, especially, from wanting it, is that question about infertility.
Sure.
Which is completely wrong. It's not true. That question came about because the protein on the coronavirus that this vaccine aims at, someone, I'm not even sure who the initial person was who put that out there, said that that protein matches a protein that our bodies use to build placenta protein. So the fear was, if you get the vaccine, it'll make your body not be able to make a placenta, and then you're infertile, can't have a baby. But that is completely debunked. There's less than 1% of the genetic material matches between the coronavirus spike protein and this placental protein. So our immune system is not smart enough to figure that part out. So there's no way it can cause problems with pregnancy. And I look at the flip side, if it really did, why are women who've had COVID still getting pregnant? Or, because in the studies of people who have had COVID, they're still having healthy pregnancies. But then again, getting COVID while you're pregnant can make you get sicker than if you're not. So, I mean, there's so many ways to look at that. But really, I tell women, this is safe. You should do it for yourself, your current kids, your future kids. It's very safe.
Absolutely. I just have one other question, and it's not really related to vaccines or this current pandemic necessarily at all. But this is a history podcast, and we like to connect the past and the present whenever possible. So I'm just curious, do you have a favorite instance in the history of medicine, you know, your field that you've come across that has really blown you away and made you curious about the medicine of previous times?
I think the bravery of doctors, nurses on battlefields.
Sure.
You know, they may have been working in a quote real hospital at some point in their career, and then they're called to work in a battlefield hospital, whether it's Revolutionary War, Civil War, like MASH on TV, you know, and just how a doctor would know, if I only had this tool or clean water or actual antibiotics, you know, they could save people. Or, you know, just the fear of working where you know you can't save someone, but you do the very best you can and have to improvise. I can't even imagine the adrenaline, the fear, the anxiety that would provoke.
Absolutely. I know that it's a statistic that is not necessarily well known, but during the Civil War, I think of the, you know, 700 plus thousand people who died, 2/3 actually died of disease. Only 1/3 died of battle wounds. So you're talking about a lot of people who are in some cases not even making it to the conflict that they're there to fight. They're dying behind the lines of, you know, some things like typhoid or just all sorts of terrible things, or from, you know, from a wound that is cut off because there's no other way to treat it.
Right.
And yeah, it's just amazing.
I think that's a really a good correlation too, that, you know, those things have happened in the past and we have a little taste of that now in our general population, with, you know, running out of supplies and not knowing what to do. And right. I don't know, do you feel like we can look to the past to kind of give us some strength about the current situation and a correlation there?
Yes, I mean, both of you brought up points about, yes, supplies. Initially, so many healthcare workers were getting sick and dying in those hard hit hospitals on the coast because they didn't, for one, we didn't know how cautious to be, and then two, didn't have enough masks and supplies to protect everyone. So even in these last few months, we've come a long way.
Right.
So, and then you mentioned diseases, you know, typhoid, and then there was diphtheria.
Yeah.
Those are diseases that we don't get typhoid vaccines unless you're going to be maybe going overseas or somewhere. But here in the U.S., nearly every child is immunized against diphtheria. Imagine thinking you could be a healthy young soldier and you're going to die of a respiratory illness when you're going to battle. And I think that's part of the problem with vaccine hesitancy, not just for COVID, but for everything, is we as public are a couple generations away from seeing people die of these routinely preventable diseases. And we're not even that far removed. When I was a resident, so 20, 25 years ago, I took care of some babies that died of Hib meningitis. They were healthy, 6 months, one was a year old. And it makes me emotional to think about it. I remember being overjoyed. We were reading articles saying this vaccine is going to be developed in our lifetime. And it ended up being like within my residency that we could start giving babies vaccines against that. I haven't seen a baby with that type of meningitis for 15 years.
Wow.
And it was just horrific that we couldn't prevent it and now we can. And so when parents or anybody says, we don't need that, that makes me cringe. It really does.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where it's actually like a lack of knowledge of history that might be somewhat to blame for the lack of interest in a vaccination. Like if you knew of, you know, what your ancestors went through, if you had some experience in your lifetime of dealing with any of those sorts of things, it might make you appreciate what you have now. But, you know, again, like you said, like people, like, I don't have scarlet fever. Why would I ever need to be, you know, I don't know anybody who's ever had scarlet fever. Why do I need a vaccination for? I mean, and I don't know, is there a vaccination for scarlet fever?
Actually, no.
Yeah.
There's antibiotics, though.
You can put antibiotics in there.
Yes, take an antibiotic.
Yeah, I've never had polio before. No one I know has had it.
Right. Right. But, you know, that's, again, that doesn't put, I don't want to put firm, like, fault on people who don't realize that. That's what progress has done. It's given us this cushion that we don't have to worry about it, but only if we continue to take care of ourselves and our neighbor by listening to science and getting vaccines that we know are proven and safe.
I think that's a good note to end on. Dr. Stanky, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I enjoyed this conversation immensely.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. It was fun.
Join us again next week for another episode of the Stir Crazy Podcast. I will be here, as always, Rob Nelson alongside Mike Bachoven. Thank you and see you next week.